Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast. And today, it's still a transatlantic football podcast today because you've got me, Jack Collins. There's no Dean Jones today, but I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by the brilliant Casey Settleman, head of content and lead soccer guy for one of the fastest growing media networks in the business, Snapback Sports, and a proud member of the Rank Squad to boot. Casey, how are you doing? I'm so delighted to have you here on the channel.
Yeah, I'm fantastic. I was just telling you, I feel like this whole journey was worth it. The fact that I get to be on a show that I've been listening to for so long. So I'm very excited.
Casey, it's a pleasure to have you on and seeing what you did during the World Cup. Incredible content, incredible experience to go out there and see it all. And we're going to be doing some mini rankings today all around that in real life experiences of the World Cup, which I think you can probably bring better than almost anyone else on the planet. But to let people understand why, Casey, I think they need to know the story of what you did during this World Cup. A game for every single day of the tournament, flying around the country, getting amongst the thick of it, which is exactly what Snapback's kind of MO is, if you will. But can you explain all of it for us first and foremost?
Yeah. So Snapback Sports, we travel the world, mostly the United States, looking for the best experience in sports. And I am the soccer guy, football guy at the company. So when the World Cup got announced it was coming here, we were going through our plans of what we're going to do. And what I pitched was a 6-part series, which was visiting one country for each continent and comparing between the six. And then my boss, who's also my brother, was like, what about going to a game every single day of the tournament? And I thought he was joking at first, so I kind of just laughed it off, continued with my pitch to the rest of the company. And then he was like, no, I'm serious. I've already mapped it out. Logistically, it makes sense. And I was like, right away, you're like, once in a lifetime opportunity, yes. And then 30 minutes later, you sit down and you're like, wait, am I sure that I want to do this? So then I texted my girlfriend. She was like, I just want it documented. This is the first time I've cried over your travels. So I'm very excited for you. So that's kind of how it all came about. And it turned out to be the best summer of my entire life.
How was it being on the road for that long? Because, you know, I looked at it. I was out in Miami for a week. It was incredible, but I was in one place in a studio. I went to one game and all of those things were a wonderful experience. I can imagine that whilst there is clearly the element of this is just unbelievable, what am I kind of experiencing, and the constant kind of adrenaline rush of doing it, I'd also imagine it was incredibly tiring.
Yeah, it was tough, of course, being on the road, you know, I was getting between 3 to 5 hours of sleep pretty much every single night because I was taking the first flight out every morning to get there in time to do as much coverage around the game and then the game itself as possible. I think a couple big things that helped was I live in New York City and I went to 5 games at MetLife. So being able to like come home, although you don't feel settled at all, just sleeping in your own bed was a nice break. And then also my brother lives in Miami, which I went to, I believe, 4 games there, which I also, you know, you sleep in a guest room, but it's not a hotel. You have people cooking your meal when you get home from the game. So I think that was very key. If I didn't live or have people in any of the host cities, I think it would have been way more difficult, just hotels for 39 straight days. But that was a helpful component of it.
Yeah. I mean, look, home comforts are always welcome, I think, when you find these days on the road. Totally. Let's get into it, Casey, shall we? Because I think what we can do here is work through this. And yeah, as I said before, I don't know if anyone is better equipped to be able to have these conversations because, you know, so many people went to World Cup games across the States, but so many of our listenership will have experienced it through Dean and I talking about these things, experiencing, watching on TV, and all of those have their own merits, right? But I think getting that in real life experience is something pretty special to this episode. So I'm really looking forward to this. So we're going to do 6 kind of mini rankings in this bit. And I'll start off pretty simply, kind of 3-2-1. What were your favorite 3 games that you saw during the World Cup?
Yeah. So at 3 was Algeria, Austria. This one kind of felt like it was forgotten about. It was late at night, But and like the first half was as boring as people expected it to be, frankly. And then it all kicked off. Obviously, the two goals in extra time, both teams going through, only Algeria going through, then back to both teams advancing. Like, it was just so insane that, and I think it's almost cool that I feel like it was a little bit slept, like people were literally asleep for it, and like it didn't get as much coverage. So I kind of loved that a little bit. That game was out of control just based off of expectation wise. People were like, they're going to go for a draw, it's going to be boring. And then it ended up being insane. Number two is Argentina Cabo Verde. I mean, this one, you really don't need to explain, like the fact that they took them as far as they did, getting to see Messi score as someone who didn't have never gotten to see him score live in person before. So adding that along with that. And then obviously that goal, I can't even fathom when that went in. I was deep in the Argentina section and like I couldn't celebrate. But seeing that, I was like, that's insanity. And then finally, number one is England-Mexico at the Azteca. That's an experience that you can't get. And I mean, the game itself was obviously insane. The goals, 10 men. But the experience was like nothing you can get in American sport for someone who's gone to 150 sporting events. This was like nothing I've seen before.
It's a funny one. And look, we might come back to that when we come back to atmospheres a little bit later on, I'd imagine. But I think what's really kind of biblical about that game is the weather going on around it, the delay, the conversations we'd had for days about altitude.
Right, altitude
and
yep.
Then it all making, you know, into this wild end-to-end encounter where both teams just, it was a heavyweight contest, right? Two sluggers in the ring just hammering at each other for as much as you could imagine. And I think that all of it, you know, I was sitting in a cabana in Miami watching it with a thunderstorm going on there. And I was like, this is pretty biblical. And I'm watching it on TV. You know, you get to speak to people who'd come back from Mexico the week after. And it was like, I don't think I'm ever going to experience anything like that in my life. And, you know, I was talking to Jim Proudfoot, the commentator. He's like, it's always easy to be recency biased, but like, that's the best game I've ever seen. He's like, but I think it is the best game I've ever seen. It had absolutely everything that you would have wanted. And I think it probably will be, in many ways, the defining game of this World Cup, the one that will stand out in years to come. But I love that you picked up on the, you know, the Algeria-Austria game. That's such a great shout, because it was on at 4 a.m. here in the UK. So there was a lot of people asleep already. But I think what was fun about it from that perspective is I know a lot of people who had like bets on Austria progressing, on Algeria progressing, they're working out the third place teams, and that late goal being like, they've completely ruined it. I've bet across four different groups. It's all been ruined by this game. And then getting the kind of reaction back to it as well the other way. For a game that was supposed to be the dullest game of this World Cup, I think that what it delivered compared to what was expected is always quite special.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And a lot of people, this was the last day, and a lot of people were telling me to change my schedule because this was Portugal-Colombia. And they were like that. And then that ended up obviously not being super entertaining. And then getting this after was just amazing.
Yeah. The decision to hold your ground on that one very much paid off, Casey. Absolutely. All right, let's go on to something slightly different. In what are your favorite three stadiums that you visited? And look, I think this is really interesting because obviously there is differences in terms of some of these stadiums, especially in Mexico and Canada, are places that have been built for soccer. We kind of go around it. You could, you know, add Seattle into that list as well. And then you're going around and experiencing things that you've probably been to from, you know, an American football perspective before, and seeing them in a different form. So I'm really intrigued to what you made of this.
Yeah, I'd imagine my list is going to be extremely different from anyone else visiting who was, you know, I saw so many videos that were like, we need to apologize to Americans. These stadiums are insane, yada, yada, yada. But like you said, I've been to all of them. So I do need to give a shout out to Atlanta and Dallas. Both of those stadiums are absolutely fantastic, but I've been to both multiple times. Atlanta also for soccer and American football. So my list is Vancouver at 3, just because I think a lot of people talked about how awful that stadium was. So I went in with really low expectations and I actually thought it was fantastic. Everything from the concourse to the view from every seat, because I had the cheapest ticket at every single game. So I was always up top. So I was like, how good is the view from all the way up top? Vancouver was great. Number two was Toronto, where smallest stadium, they had to put in the temporary seats to get it to enough capacity, but it's right on the water. they have like this open concept. And I thought, like you said, I love the ones that are built for soccer. I thought that was super unique because we don't get that a lot in the States. You know, we have these Death Stars built that hold 70, 80,000 people. So I love the smaller stadium. And then number one is the Azteca, which funny enough, I had been to for American football, but that was pre-renovations. I was there amazing. For the NFL in Mexico game. And then coming back post-renovations, like that one is as big, but it still feels like it's built for the sport. So it still gave that, and I absolutely loved it.
It did feel, you know, there was a lot of conversations about the idea that the final should have taken place at the Azteca because of its kind of mythical World Cup history. I think what's really interesting from kind of the other side of it and not being at the stadium is there's a camera angle, especially in the daytime in the Azteca, and it looks exactly like it did in 1986. It looks exactly like it did when Mexico hosted, you know, in the years before, 1970. And you're looking at it being like, has it, you know, obviously the stands have changed, but the kind of lighting, that dappled light looks exactly mm-hmm. as it did those years ago when they've colorized those broadcasts. I find it incredible that it's managed to maintain that kind of mythic quality whilst also talking about it from like a new perspective in terms of the renovations. Now, apparently, according to the journalists I've spoken to, the Wi-Fi still doesn't work. It's a nightmare getting in and out, et cetera. But I kind of think that adds to it. But I'm intrigued because, you know, the Azteca is one of those places that's a cathedral of football, right? We have these worldwide cathedrals we always talk about, the San Siro. We talk about, you know, Old Trafford, Anfield, et cetera, within these brackets. The Azteca, you know, above many of them, maybe not San Siro, but above many of those stadiums in the kind of football mythology, if you will. And the idea that people have gone there and had these incredible experiences over the course of this tournament, I think has only gone and added to what was already a pretty prestigious view of what the Azteca holds, especially at World Cups.
100%. I couldn't agree more. And like you said, the fact that it is a little difficult to get in and out, and that is a little bit annoying, but like you said, it kind of adds to what it is. You know, the logistics for the World Cup in general were so well done, and that was kind of the only place you had to struggle a little bit. I do have to caveat, I didn't go to Monterrey, which I know a lot of people had glowing reviews of. But yeah, those are the Azteca was once in a lifetime.
I just wanted to touch back on the two Canadian stadiums because obviously, and I think in particular BC Place, we've talked a lot about legacy around this World Cup, and we're going to go off on a tangent here because, you know, this is what we do. But like you're looking at it and the future of the Caps remains kind of up in the air. There's talk of investor groups, the leases running out of BC Place. And I think on this show in particular, we've kind of focused on the US impact of what it might mean, you know, the World Cup and what the impact on soccer in the country and the growth of the game might look like. But I think that of all of the elements that we've talked about, and maybe one that's gone under the radar, is what this might do for Canadian soccer, what it might do for the Caps in terms of, you know, the sellout crowds at the stadium, the support that the Canadian national team got there. Like, if the legacy in Canada is that the Caps are saved and remain in Vancouver after this tournament, that's a legacy I think worth fighting for. And I think that the fact that you've put BC Place into this conversation there speaks to it for itself in terms of how much that matters.
Totally. And I think it's like unique and it's a dome, so it's covered, but a lot of places it's hard to then get sunlight in. So not that you feel trapped, but you feel very inside. It's like a translucent roof, which I just thought was super unique. So during the daytime, it still almost gave you the sense that you were outside, but it was air I feel like it did both really, really well. So yeah, I was a huge fan. I have some personal friends who live in Vancouver who warned me. And then I think that helped raise it up because I had such low expectations. But like you said, if it can save them, I thought it was a fantastic stadium and more people should visit.
Just on that, Casey, quickly, and again, to go on a slight side point here, and you spoke about the logistics, and I visited Miami. I had kind of a little bit of dread trying to get to that stadium. It was actually okay getting in. It was a bit of a nightmare getting out, but it wasn't the end of the world. It was just, it took a little bit longer than maybe people had hoped. Where were the places that you thought had the best kind of infrastructure going on around it? Because I've heard glowing reviews about both Philadelphia and Atlanta in terms of fans getting in and out and being back in, you know, the pub or the bars, whatever, within sort of an hour of kind of finishing.
Yeah, so I kind of broke it down into, is your stadium in or around Center City? I think is a fantastic start. So that's why you love Atlanta, because after the game, you can just walk to 15, 20, 30 different restaurants, bars, and they also have if you're in Center City, your public transit is right there. So if you do want to get out, it's super simple. I comp that to Seattle as well. That's right in pretty much downtown. Same with Philadelphia, like you said. So that was a huge one. I think the places like MetLife and Foxborough, which are so far from Center City, they actually did a good job with getting people in and out from back to downtown Boston and back to New York City. But the fact of the matter is, it's an hour getting you back regardless. So, you know, it can kill a little bit of that. So Vancouver and Toronto, partly why I love them so much, is because they're massive cities that are close or right in the middle of downtown, and their public transit is super simple. So it's like, it would be like if New York City had the stadium essentially in Central Park. Like, you would just be able to get around, walk to restaurants and bars. So yeah, I was a huge fan of both the Canadian cities. That's partly why I loved it so much. And then obviously we talked about the Azteca and the issues that came from that. But, you know, when you create such a special experience, we let you off when it takes a little to get out.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I loved it. I'd never been to Hard Rock before. And, you know, seeing the kind of vastness of it was really quite something for me. But, you know, the those 2 hours afterwards, getting a bus and, you know, and getting an Uber from where the bus dropped you off, did kind of kill the momentum of an evening, I think, a little bit, especially when the game ends a little bit later. But we are where we are. I'll tell you what, let's combine those two conversations, because, you know, you spoke about the games that you love the most in terms of on the pitch, but what were the three best game atmospheres that you went to, which kind of does mix these up in terms of, we'll do fan bases after this, but those individual games that had the best atmospheres around them?
Yeah, atmosphere-wise, I'm going to go with Portugal-Croatia at number three. I think this partly plays into how crazy the game got, especially at the end, but, you know, Ronaldo's sister had just announced his retirement. So you went into that match thinking this is either Modric or Ronaldo's last World Cup match. So that played a part into it. And then I didn't know that there was such a big population of both Portuguese and Croatians in Toronto, which I learned the march down to the stadium with the Portugal fans was the biggest march I saw the entire tournament. So that kind of blew me away. And then when you get the smaller stadium in Toronto, it feels like everything's kind of on top of you, and it creates a really good atmosphere. That's something that, like in Dallas, when it's so big, you can lose. So Portugal, Croatia was three. England, Argentina was two. So funny enough, they don't teach about, unless I missed it in history class and I wasn't paying attention, they don't teach all the history between England and Argentina.
They don't tend to. There's a lot. We don't even get really that conversation here in the UK. So I'd be very surprised if you got it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I had no clue. I knew about the history on the pitch between the two, but not off. And then everything that came, like, those were two of my favorite fan bases to begin with. But that combo of teams just took it to a different level, to where that was number two. And then obviously number one, England, Mexico at the Azteca. Like you said, everything that came with it. First off, people were telling me, be careful if you're going to wear an England jersey. If they win, it could be dangerous if you leave. So you go in with that in your mind. Then you have the rain delay. Obviously, people talking about the altitude at nauseam, the delay, everything that happens on the, like, that was just insanity from top to bottom, the whole England-Mexico experience at the Azteca. So that has to come in at number one.
When the rain delay happened, were you already in the stadium? So was it just everyone in the concourses? Because I always feel, and it's funny, we get this often with kind of further away games that we get here in the UK. You know, everyone's sort of in the stadium much earlier. Like when Fulham are playing at home, I'm in my seat, you know, 3 minutes before the kickoff, right? Like, and I've come into the ground 5 minutes before that. Whereas I think if you've traveled away, there is that kind of build up in the stadium. You get it at halftime a little bit more, you know, and I always feel like the concourses are the best place to get the chants, get the songs and all of those experiences. Were you all just in the stadium whilst this rain delay was going on?
Everyone was in the stadium because, one, you didn't want to be in transit as the weather was coming. Like the Azteca,
so fair. I'd never even considered that.
The Azteca kind of has areas around to, if you wanted to go to a bar, but I felt like for the most part at all these matches, everyone was kind of in at least like an hour and a half before the match, but especially for this one. Yeah, everyone was in there. You were either in the concourse or they have restaurants and places to get beers like that are kind of right outside the concourse, but still inside the grounds once you scan your ticket. And that's where everyone was, just like under umbrellas, drinking, chanting. It created such a fun, unique atmosphere because everyone was kind of just like, this is going to be our reality. Let's just soak it in and like make the best of what is going to be a long night.
So two more questions on this. One, I know you were at the US-Australia game and, you know, I had friends in Seattle who were covering that and making things happen. And, you know, I think that maybe the most iconic piece of commentary that might come out of this World Cup is, you know, Freeman's goal is good and the ground shakes in Seattle. And I think it's just this wonderful thing. And then obviously there's the end of that game and knowing that the US have got through the group stage, they've won the group. I was a little surprised you didn't have this in there.
It's, you know, it's funny. It was number four, but you only gave me three. No, it's the reality is I love the U.S. men's national team. I love that it is going to continue to grow here. But the reality of the situation is that loud crowd is the same loud crowd I've heard at countless NFL college football games. Sure. And there just is a different feeling, like, when it comes to soccer, that it was super loud. It was an amazing atmosphere. Don't get me wrong, but I want to hear chants. I want to hear the level of passion that between the goals were still making a ton of noise. Whereas with the American fans and, you know, the American Outlaws did a great job. We had a huge march down to the stadium in Seattle. So not knocking them on anything, but the reality is what I love about soccer is it's 90 minutes standing chanting. We just don't have that here yet. So for me, it was just a very loud NFL game, and it was cool that it happened at a soccer game.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally fair. And shout out to the Outlaws. We watched the game against Belgium in the pub in Miami with the Outlaws. And obviously not the outcome anyone was hoping for, but the scenes when the equalizer went in were pretty special. And I've never been given free shots in a pub when a team scores. Just walking around with a bottle of whiskey pouring it out. I was like, this is amazing. Like, I could go for more of this. So yeah, a huge shout out to the Outlaws. The other one I did want to just mention, because we're not going to sort of knock on all of the bad points, but also one of your videos was, I saw the worst fans and the worst atmosphere of the World Cup, the Uruguay game. What did you make of that? Because that was a deeply saddening experience, because Uruguay is such a proud footballing nation. I was lucky enough to be there earlier in the year. And, you know, hearing them speak about football with such this kind of verve and vigor, and the World Cup kind of tops it. I think it's South America generally, but that talking about the World Cup and the national team was, they were so excited back in January, and for it all to come crashing down in the way that it did felt very, very bleak.
I was so, so shocked, because I went to two Uruguay matches, and one of my biggest takeaways is the passion kind of just outside of England. The passion in South America for soccer is actually just different than it is in Europe. What I felt from Colombia, what I felt from Argentina and Brazil was like completely different than what I felt with a Spain, a France, and things of that nature. That the fact that Uruguay, I know the history that comes, I know it's also been a while, obviously, but yeah. I was just shocked that they brought such a lack, like they had probably 70% of the stadium, 20% was Americans, and then 10% was Saudi Arabia fans. And the Saudis were the ones making the noise the entire time. I was just like so confused. Granted, Uruguay was awful from start to finish, so an underwhelming performance is always going to affect the atmosphere to begin with. But even for the anthem and then the first 5 to 10 minutes where they wouldn't have known that the team was going to be awful throughout the entire tournament, they still weren't bringing. So I was really shocked, because that was my, I had saw Brazil the night or two nights previous, and I'm like, another South American country, this is going to be fantastic. And it disappointed big time.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think they came in, you know, in January when I was speaking to them, there was still a real sense of optimism. I think by the time the World Cup began, there was a real sense of doom that was kind of encircling them before a ball was even kicked. And maybe that kind of plays into it. And look, you talk about fervor from the South American nations. They're also very quick. When it turns very quickly the other way. And it can get quite sort of, we hate this team more, you know, as quickly as it's been, we absolutely adore this. And maybe that just plays into account on it. All right, let's roll it onwards to the best three fan bases that you spent time with. And I think maybe, Casey, this is the one I'm most excited to hear.
Yeah, so it's what you just said is so fascinating, because number one, up until the final, was Argentina. Because like I said, that passion is just different. but I saw them win two matches. So I saw the best version of them. Now, when they lost, I saw a version of Argentinians that I honestly wish I didn't see, because it left a and we saw it on the pitch and it reflected off the pitch. They are very sore losers. And this means everything to them at a World Cup final. That is not lost on me, but there is still, you can be as upset as you want without harassing Spanish fans around you. And it's not like people were provoking them or anything like that. So it is unfortunate, because I loved being around them. The passion they have, especially watching Messi potentially final World Cup, it was just different. And it was so special to feel that. And luckily I got that experience as they were winning, but then that left a little knock on me after. So number three is Norway. They were fantastic. I mean, a country that small with such little history, bringing over this level of passion and just fun, honestly, from them. And then, you know, the team performance definitely aids in that. But I saw them versus France playing their B team, getting absolutely trounced. And they were the ones chanting, making the noise the entire time. Now, they had qualified and they had accepted that they were playing the B team. So it was kind of just there to celebrate and party. But I was still impressed, chanting minute one to minute 90, getting beat by this France side. So Norway, without a doubt, number three. And so I move Argentina down to number two. But they almost throw out their shoulders chanting to the players. It's something that I've never seen before. I've seen passionate chants, but the way they chant is almost like they are trying to put the chant into the bodies of the players, like send it to them. I had never seen anything like that. And due to them being sore losers, I did move England up to number one. Previous to the final, Argentina was one and England was two, but I did flop them. I did flip them.
Okay. I mean, look, this is something that Dean Jones will be delighted to hear this as much as anyone else, right? But like, I think that this has been, you know, I was in Miami and I was a little bit worried, you know, when England came to town one, I was like, I want to be the only person here with an English accent. I want to be, you know, unique in this experience and seeing kind of the clash, which was potentially proposed between Brazil and Mexico, felt like it could be a lot of fun in Miami in particular. But, you know, when it got there, I had such a good experience out in the bars and, you know, seeing people, you know, having fun. There is a level of this, and I do wonder in terms of, you know, what this World Cup was, and we'll get onto, you know, the spend and the cost of all of it at some point a little bit later, whether, you know, a lot of people were priced out. I mean, fundamentally, a lot of people were priced out, but also for sure, whether that meant that, you know, it was a slightly kind of nicer crowd for certain nations who maybe had to travel a little bit further than perhaps they would have been. But I think that England fans' reputation has had a bit of a rehabilitation. I think over the last 10 years or so, there have been isolated moments, but for the most part, people have always talked about them in a good light, I think, over the last 10 years. And so it's really interesting to hear you kind of see that and get amongst it and understand it, especially coming from not an alien point of view, but standing slightly outside of it.
For sure. Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because I came in with, that's what I knew, I guess, hooliganism or whatever you want to describe it. They have a reputation that precedes them. And then we talk about, a lot of people were like, the fact that they're not segregating crowds at this England, Argentina, it could be dangerous, this, that, and the next. And then if I could have figured out a way for that match to end, for it to kick off after the match, it would have been exactly how that match played out. And I was honestly shocked. The only fighting I saw was actually between England fans. So that was, I was, I guess, shocked, pleasantly surprised, you could say, that nothing happened after the England-Argentina game. But yeah, all my experiences with the England fans were super kind. And like you said, did it bring a different level because of how expensive it was, potentially? But yeah, they were fantastic. Limited, again, I only see as much as I can see, but yeah, to what I saw, no issues created by the England fans.
I would be remiss, Casey, not to ask you. You did a video about Scotland and England fans together. I'll be remiss not to ask you. They have come back from this World Cup, Scotland, I think, with the hearts of Boston very much kind of have taken. But what did you make of it? Because there has been a real love affair, I think, between the Scotland fans and Boston. There has been a real slew of praise for them. I've spent time with the Scotland fans. I was there at Euro 2024, and I spent a lot of time in Cologne with them and had the most incredible time. I'm intrigued by, you know, their omission, shall we say. And I know that there's a lot of the ranked squad in Scotland who'll be screaming at this podcast right now.
Yes, I need. So we talk about how I didn't change from Algeria, Austria to Portugal, Colombia. This was a change that I did make. We were originally scheduled Morocco, Haiti, and we changed to do Brazil, Scotland, because we saw everything that happened in Boston. I fear that, one, they kind of left it all out there in Boston. And it was amazing and everything I saw, but I can only rate on what I experienced
myself.
100%. So then when they came to Miami, they had the march downtown. I think they had a fantastic time in South Beach. And then when it came to game time, it was so hot. I think they might've been a little tired, maybe a little hungover. And then when they got there, it just didn't produce the same vibes that I was seeing in Boston, which was obviously hugely disappointing. And then the anthem was absolutely fantastic. And then their performance, again, this was their World Cup life on the line. So it's not like Norway, where if you're getting beaten, you're already advanced, you can just get over it. Like I do sympathize with them. They didn't put, you know, they handed Brazil that match from start to finish. And so there's Boston, Scotland, I think, that deserves a rating, which I can't do. And then there's Miami, Scotland, which I unfortunately did have to do.
Okay, fair enough. I think that's the most reasonable explanation that you could have given. It was bloody hot in Miami. And I tell you this, the Celtic skin did not deal with it well. And I can speak from personal experience on that one. Let's shift it onwards then to our penultimate ranking here, which is the best three individual performances you got to see from players in all of these games that you saw, Casey.
Yeah, so there's so many omissions that I wish I saw Dembele have a hat trick, but it was against Norway's B team. But where I'll start is Olise, match number one against Senegal. So he started out, so obviously being a huge Harry Kane fan and a Tottenham fan, I primarily watch Tottenham Premier League, but then I pretty much watch every single Bayern Munich game. So watching Olise all season, I was like, I cannot wait to see him in person. He started out on that right side. And then I don't know at what point in the match he moved to the 10, but it was, the ball to Mbappe, the assist on their opener. And then he was just fantastic the entire match. And I think that's when he came out with his quote about, like, I feel more comfortable in the 10, or I've always played there, whatever it may be. So that was absolutely fantastic. Number two is kind of a double up. The DR Congo goalie, I apologize, I don't know his name, versus England. He was fantastic. I was like, they're actually not going to score just because of him. And then I flipped it onto the Kane performance. The second goal more than the first, but both of those goals to carry England past DR Congo was kind of like a double unreal performance by both of them. And then number one, I'm obviously not as smart as you guys are in analyzing the game, but I'd like to think I'm more than a casual in the sense of if you don't score or assist, I can still identify a good performance. So when I watched Buadi against Brazil in their opener, I was like, I think that's one of the greatest midfielding performances I've ever seen. And then I go to Twitter after the match and everybody's talking about it. And I was like, okay, good. Everyone just saw what I saw, and he's getting linked to every club, every big club in the world after that performance. But I walked away. I was like, that was fantastic.
I mean, he was very, very special. We did a couple of episodes in the middle of it being like, his transfer value was already pretty high, but it has skyrocketed. I love your number two there, though. Lionel Mpassi, who's been the backup goalkeeper for Le Havre, right, for the past season, behind Moura Diaw, who played for Senegal over the course of this World Cup. So seeing them both, Le Havre have had some impressive goalkeeping performances to be like, there you go, these are the guys. But the idea of it being like, oh, it's the keeper, and then seeing Harry Kane be the man to turn it around, I think is an excellent double up. I very much enjoyed that, Casey. They are some some really special things I think you've seen in all of these moments. And look, just to finish it off and something slightly more off the beaten track, if you will, I know that at Snapback, you do the food at the stadium is a big part of the experience. And we'll talk a little bit more about that and the rating system at the end of the podcast. But also, where did you get the best stadium food and what were the experiences like? Because this is something that I and plenty of others cannot speak about at all.
Yeah, so I have three. So starting with BC Place, partly maybe why I loved Vancouver and BC Place. I got short rib poutine and Hawaiian pizza. I'd never had Hawaiian pizza before. I don't know why. I always was in the camp of, oh, pineapple on pizza is horrible. But I tried it. It was actually fantastic. I mean, for stadium food. So BC Place comes in at number three. MetLife Stadium, I got a lobster roll. And people were like, why are you getting fresh seafood at a stadium? But it was fantastic, and I felt great after the fact, which was people's concerns. Anyway, so that was very good. And then number one, Atlanta is kind of a combination because you can get Chick-fil-A there, which I absolutely love Chick-fil-A, which I feel like is just a hack that they serve it at their stadium. And then also before the semifinal, they had a $20 like value meal essentially, where I got popcorn, hot dog, chicken tenders, fries, nachos, pretzel, and a fountain soda, all for $20. And a pizza. And were all the items great? No, but if you hit on half of them, you're still getting way more of your value for $20. So, and they do their concessions well priced the entire time, but this was something special that they made for their last game they were hosting. And I think that deserved a shout as well.
Yeah, bang for your buck, always important in these ones. It's funny because the only stadium food I had on my travels was when I went to the Marlins in Miami, and they did the machete, which is like the 2 foot long quesadilla, which was absolutely incredible, but also cost more than your entire value meal that you've just described right there. So I'm feeling a little bit gutted. Atlanta is the stadium. I'd love to go to Lumen Field, and I'd love to go and see, you know, the Sounders play there. But I think going to see the Five Stripes play at Mercedes-Benz and going and experiencing that stadium and that atmosphere and it being in the middle of town is right up at the top of my hit list, I think, in terms of MLS. So you're selling me even more, Casey. So thank you. And look, that will take us to the end of these rankings. But just, you know, a couple of other points. You know, I was reading your brother's kind of write-up of the cost that it took to go to all of these games, $85,000 effectively to do this entire trip. And the way that you guys have posted that and shown how the costs were all covered and all of those things, I think is really cool, right? Like as just the transparency of all of that. But it was an expensive World Cup. I mean, look, not everyone has gone to 33 games, right? So it's going to be different in terms of where you go. But I mean, what did you make of the fact that it was the tickets cost what they did, that the travel would have cost what it did for people to follow their national teams about? What did you make to it as a kind of general point?
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunately, as an American, just something we're used to. I mean, my brother just paid, I don't even know how much, to go to an NBA Finals Knicks game, you know, in New York. So in the worst way ever possible, we are almost desensitized to it, which sucks to say. But especially soccer, football, the people's game, the world game, whatever it may be, I understand people's aversion to how much this costs. I was talking to an Argentinian fan before the final who talked about how his ticket to the final in Qatar was $750. And because it was so cheap, he ended up flying his dad out, flights, hotels, ticket, all comped for less than his ticket to just the final in New York was. So I understand everyone's complaints around it. And it, of course, made certain atmospheres way worse. It also, a little bit of it, made me appreciate like how well Argentinians traveled and how they literally will save everything just to be at it, you know, the Argentina World Cup. Same with England fans. It almost made me appreciate more. And that's, of course, unfair because, you know, some money is just something you can't avoid. But it does make me appreciate more how much certain fan bases were willing to spend to be there because it means so much to them. So you know, it sucks. That's the bottom line. But there are, I guess, some silver linings around it you can try and find.
No, I mean, look, you have to take it at face value, right? And there is already this push to take the World Cup back in 2038, which I imagine will be a delight to American soccer fans, but also the rest of the world will be like, oh, no, please. But like, you know, you spoke about Norway earlier and those fan bases. Norway is a country with, you know, a really, really strong economy where, you know, the minimum wage is so incredibly high, you know, the strong GDP of it. When we talk about countries traveling brilliantly, and Norway did travel brilliantly, this shouldn't take away from anything that they did and any of the love that they've gotten, but it's more amenable, right? Like it's more available to the country considering the fact that it is a wealthy nation. And the thing I think that makes me sad about this is not the idea that, you know, oh, we have to cap ticket prices or anything like that. One, I think that they should have given 1,000 tickets to schools or local soccer clubs in the areas to kind of inspire that next generation and allow them to experience it in the flesh. That's kind of at odds with what this tournament has looked like from a financial perspective. Right. And two, I think we didn't get quite the same color, you know, around some of these games. You know, we spoke about the Qatari World Cup, which came with its own problems, right? And we're not going to gloss over those and we're not sweeping them under the carpet. There were major issues with that World Cup. But one of the things that was in its favor was this incredible swathe of support, I think, for the African nations that we saw in maybe the best possible way in that regard, we didn't maybe see this time round. And look, that's a shame, I think, you know, to get all of these cultures and combinations together in the same place. It is part of what makes the World Cup so magical. But yeah, look, there's nothing I'm going to be able to do about it. There's nothing you're going to be able to do about it, Casey. And we're sort of shouting into the ether at this point. But, you know, it's always worth making it, I think. I mean, final question for you. And also, I think maybe you could use this to explain about the snackback experience rate on the website, for example. Currently top of the list of the best experiences on there, and there's 187 of them. I think this is very, very special. Is PSG's 4-2 win over Manchester City in the Champions League in January 2025. The World Cup games aren't on that list yet, I imagine. But one, did any of them top that experience? And two, you want to just explain a little bit about what it is and how you guys make it, because it's really, really cool. And I've never seen anything like it before.
Yeah, so it is our rating system. We figured we need to, if we're going to go to all these sporting events, we need to put some stakes and, you know, our little twist on it. So we were like, let's make a rating system. It's weighted on four categories. So you have the fans / the atmosphere, you have food, you have uniqueness. So that's kind of everything that wouldn't fit into four categories. And then stadium, city, and gameplay is kind of combined in those three. And it's weighted. Fans and atmosphere is a 0.35. Stadium City gameplay is a 0.35, and then uniqueness and food is a 0.15. So it's weighted about, you know, the food in the stadium shouldn't outweigh how great the fans and atmosphere are.
Yeah, sure.
So that is what we do as a company, is we rate the experiences we go to. Now, the interesting question you asked is, did any of them top the experience scale? We actually, which maybe is a bad business decision, we actually didn't rank them on the experience scale for a couple reasons. One, the uniqueness portion, like you're not going to, the games themselves didn't change that much in terms of what is unique. Like you can bump it up a little. I got to see Messi. I got to see Ronaldo. I got to see Modric at his last, but like the uniqueness is only going to go so far. We also were repeating the stadiums and cities multiple times. So that category starts to become redundant. So I kind of just, my goal was integrate myself with as many fan bases as I possibly can. And we just did a fan rankings throughout the entire time until I think we started doing it in the quarterfinals and semifinals, which is why it's an interesting question, because I kind of want to re-rate. I want to go back and do England-Mexico and see where that would have landed at the Azteca. But we did rank England-Argentina, the semifinal, and that came in at an 8.11, which is 13th all time out of 187. It's not public just yet, but that's still a full point and change behind the 9.15 that the PSG Champions League match had. So I think you've inspired me to go rank the England-Mexico match at the Azteca and see where that lands.
I think that might just be in the conversation. It might not top it, but I think it'll be in the conversation. Casey, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Do you want to let everyone know where they can find you, where they can kind of listen to your work going forward, and what the plan is next, I suppose, for soccer on Snapback?
Yeah, so everything Snapback sports-wise, if American sports and a sports media company in general interests you, or Snapback Sports Everywhere. My personal channels, CSET13 and Casey Settleman 13 across platforms for my soccer stuff continuing through. And speaking of that, and speaking of the price thing you were talking about earlier, my goal is to continue making soccer content through this year and then hopefully live in London for the 27-28 season, follow Tottenham, go to a bunch of away days for different teams, and then do this all again at the Euros, which people have told me when I tease that it's going to be much cheaper than it was to do it here. So yeah, that's my goal, is to live in London for a year, potentially go to as many Tottenham games as possible, see as many different... Luckily, I've made so many English friends that I've been invited to, I think, every single tier of English football for an experience. So that will be fantastic. And then do it all again at the Euros, because I loved being with the England fans.
Well, Casey, you also have an open invite to Craven Cottage whenever you need it as well. Mate, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out and sharing your experiences with us. I think this has been such a unique thing, and I've been so impressed with everything you've done over the course of this tournament, my friend.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This was fantastic.
The brilliant Casey Settleman. Do make sure you go and follow Snapback Sports and Casey's individual channels as he goes on with this soccer crusade across the US. This has been Ranks FC. All that's left for me to do is say thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you all very shortly, Ranks Squad. Take it easy. Peace.